KCSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and this year a visiting research collaborator at Princeton's Center for Information Technology Policy. Thank you for joining me on what will be the last show of the spring quarter on KCSU-FM's schedule. I'm very pleased to have on the co-editors of the book, The ACTA and the Plurilateral Enforcement Agenda. The editors are Pedro Ruff and Javi Silva, and they are both joining us via Skype, Javi from Strasbourg and Pedro from near Geneva, to discuss this wonderful compendium of articles involving the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement. For those that have been listening to Hearsay Culture over the last several years, you will recall a few years ago, I'm thinking 2010, 2011, there was heavy discussion at the international level involving what came to be known as ACTA. And ACTA was the first, I think, modern effort at the international level to go after what we know as copyright piracy or copyright infringement on the internet. The idea of linking to and sharing copyrighted works over the internet and the impacts that it has allegedly had on the entertainment industry. ACTA was designed to create not only law at the international level around combating piracy, but even an institution that would then regulate and govern and enforce these rules. But ACTA was marred from the beginning not only by substantive concerns, but also secrecy around the negotiations. And one of the major issues that we've been facing generally in not only the United States and not only negotiating countries, and ACTA involved European countries as well as the United States, but really internationally, are the secrecy around international negotiations. So there really was a two-level concern with regard to ACTA. One was substantive, the other was procedural. Now, of course, the genesis of ACTA came out of the broad concerns involving copyright infringement and piracy on the internet, which are now very well known and really began as soon as the commercial internet was available. So it started with file sharing and went through peer-to-peer technology, and now it involves Dropbox and cyber lockers and the like. These are real issues. There's no doubt that there is copyright infringement and piracy. There is an open question as to, first, how much is happening, and then secondly, what the remedy should be for that activity. And ACTA was designed to deal with those issues. In this book, The ACTA and the Plurilateral Enforcement Agenda, Javi and Pedro have brought together a wonderful group of scholars to write on a variety of issues, from the substantive issues to the political and domestic challenges to related issues, stakeholders, which involves public input, and the future. And as I went through the list of authors on in the book, many of them have been involved with the show and have been people that I have worked with, from people like Peter Yu to Sean Flynn to Andrew Renz, Jonathan Band, Anne-Marie Bridie, and on and on. So it's a wonderful collection of scholars, Mike Geist among them, who was on the show several years ago and discussing these issues. And it really takes a very deep and scholarly look at a broad range of issues. For purposes of this show, we are going to focus on the writing that Javi and Pedro contributed specifically, but we're also going to get more broadly into the issues that come up here. And of course, the question becomes, well, Levine, why is it that you're discussing ACTA, which, if you haven't been following it, never ultimately became enforced and is not international law, though there have been some odd efforts from time to time. I've seen arguments made that ACTA is not being followed by entities that don't technically have to follow it. But the real issue and the real currency of it today involves the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, or TTP, and the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which is TTIP. Both of these international agreements, TTP, which is in its perhaps final stages before it goes back to the signatory countries for enactment, and TTIP, which is a negotiation between the United States and the EU that it's in its early rounds, seem to have elements of ACTA-like provisions in them, but both of those processes are marred by secrecy, TTP particularly, TTIP a little less so. So we can learn, I think, quite a bit about the ACTA experience and derive lessons from it that could be applied today, assuming that negotiating countries and others would want to do so. So we have an opportunity here to talk to two experts on the international stage on this issue, and I'm excited to have them here. By way of background, Pedro Ruff is a senior associate at the International Center for Trade and Sustainable Development, where he works on the Program on Technology Innovation and IP and Development. He advises governments, international organizations, and the like, and he's published many articles and books in this space. Javi Soiba is a senior research associate at the University of Strasbourg. He's also advised governments and international organizations. He has also written a number of books and articles in this issue. And so we have two wonderful people who are here to discuss these issues at length on Hearsay Culture. Again, the book is The ACTA and a Plurilateral Enforcement Agenda. Javi and Pedro are joining us via Skype. We are recording on March 20th, 2015. Gentlemen, thank you much for joining us today on the show.
Thank you very much to you, Dave. It is a pleasure being in your show. And, well, finally, we made it.
Yes.
Thank you very much again. And thanks for your excellent introduction. You explained very correctly the procedural and substantive aspects of ACTA. And in my particular case, well, one of my areas of research is that relating to international intellectual property enforcement. And as you pointed out, the negotiation and conclusion of ACTA was a major event in the field of international intellectual property regulation. And ACTA, in fact, is the first international treaty solely devoted to intellectual property enforcement. And for this reason, we saw that it was very timely and it could be a useful contribution editing a book such as this with a collection of chapters that describe, or we try to collect a collection of chapters that describe both the content but also the context that that surrounded the ACTA. So this is the initial intention that we had, and we ended up with this I think that more than 20 chapters, if I'm not wrong. And hopefully this will be a useful piece for any researcher or lawyer interested in current issues in intellectual property enforcement debates.
Pedro, I wanted to ask, and Javi anticipated that first question, perhaps you could talk a little bit about the genesis of this project and why you thought ACTA was worthy of this study.
Sorry, this is addressed to me?
Pedro? Yes, Pedro, yes, thank you.
Oh, no, thank you, Dave. I think this is a luxury to be with you. We really appreciate this invitation, and particularly your excellent introduction to the different issues that we're facing. Let me also underline, in a way, what Xavi was saying, that we felt that ACTA was it too large an issue to avoid analysis. I guess ACTA was relating to a number of considerations, normally competitiveness, innovation, access to knowledge, technological development, and in general, sustainable development. Let me say something about my background also. I have been looking for a number of years at what I would say the political economy of intellectual property, and I have been very much concerned, and my area of study and research has been basically the role, the place of the emerging economies, the developing countries in this area. Are we okay with the communication?
Yes, we are fine.
Okay. We felt that this was really an extremely interesting area of study to try to look at the origin of ACTA and try to draw lessons from the whole experience of ACTA. You mentioned very correctly that there is a very clear link with more current discussion, especially the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, the TTIP also. We see a very clear link in the way that these are the negotiations that are taking place, and also the issues that come back. Many of the questions that were discussed in ACTA are coming back, especially in the TPP.
So when we think about ACTA, gentlemen, and this is we can kind of both refresh the memory of listeners who have been listening and those that aren't. You know, Pedro, I'll come back to you on this, and then Javi, you could pick up. You know, ACTA was this this process, as I mentioned, designed to go particularly after copyright infringement, and perhaps you could set the stage for a deeper discussion of some of the issues you talk about in the book, to describe a bit more about the details of ACTA and what its goals and structure was. So, Pedro, perhaps I'll continue with you, and then we can go back to Javi.
Sorry, could you repeat the question?
Sure. A bit about the structure of ACTA, and more specifically, how it was designed to achieve the goal of dealing with copyright infringement.
Well, as you know, and I think this is one of the areas where we try to look at the process of ACTA. ACTA was a very ambitious project, basically trying to go beyond what was achieved in the TRIPS agreement in terms of enforcement. But at the same time, in a number of ways, ACTA, what tried to do in the area of enforcement was basically to try to reflect in a way what was already achieved, especially in the case of the United States, in a number of free trade agreements that have been signed in the last couple of years. I think the United States has signed and negotiated around 20 free trade agreements where the chapters on investment are quite developed, are quite potent in terms of strong provisions in the area of enforcement. These were reflected in the early versions of the negotiations and in the original proposals that were made in the ACTA process. But if you look, and I think this is the question that you're raising, if you look at the final act, the final act of ACTA looks an extremely, from my point of view, an extremely balanced instrument compared to what were the original proposal. Then it covers from general provisions to more specific one, and I think no doubt that one of the most outstanding area in ACTA is precisely what relates to the digital environment that, as you know, was not part of the TRIPS agreement. And this is no doubt a major advancement from that point of view.
So, Javi, let me turn to you and ask you. So, with regard to the status of ACTA, which I think is an interesting issue, it never ultimately was enforced, even though it went through domestic political processes. What is its actual status today? Is it fair to say that ACTA is completely dead?
Well, this is a very pertinent and interesting question. In fact, ACTA is an international treaty, and it is an international treaty that it is open to parties to ratify. So from that point of view, it is alive. But your question pointed at the real status of ACTA, not the formal status of ACTA. And I think that ACTA needs to be creative, and we could probably invent a different term. No, we could talk about something like failed ratifying when we think about ACTA, because lawmaking, in fact, with respect to ACTA, really worked out. Pedro was mentioning that the final act is pretty balanced, particularly if you take into consideration previous texts. But it has not been ratified. In this case, what we will see in ACTA or coming out from ACTA are effects in different areas. No? Some of these effects relate to the standards set forth in the agreement. The standards originally drafted in ACTA can be now found in our international treaties or proposals of of treaties, and they are in fact the base to monitor the respect of intellectual property rights in foreign countries. For instance, the USTR usually quotes some of the ACTA provisions when assessing the implementation of intellectual property rights in other countries. So from this point of view, ACTA probably is a failed treaty, but is a useful text. And there are other effects, probably much more related to political and social aspects, that that resulted from ACTA. For instance, I think that this is just an example, but it's quite interesting to note that when the European Parliament rejected the adoption of ACTA, European authorities rushed to announce that since then onwards, intellectual property rights regulation should be consensuated, should be treated in a more democratic fashion, if you want to put it in these terms. So the broader social interest behind intellectual property was probably recognized thanks to what was done wrongly in ACTA.
We're chatting with Pedro Ruffy and Javi Soiba, authors, but really co-editors as well, of the book The ACTA and the Plurilateral Enforcement Agenda on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So Javi, I'll continue with you and then go back to Pedro for a follow-up. So just again, for listeners that weren't paying close attention to ACTA when it was happening, both of you have mentioned that ACTA started out imbalanced and became balanced. In the context of ACTA, what is imbalanced versus balanced? In other words, what does it look like? What rights and interests enter the equation to make an agreement like ACTA balanced versus not?
Indeed. Probably it is interesting to look at the structure of ACTA, no? And if we go to the substantive aspects of ACTA, that those provisions that regulate civil, criminal, border, and digital enforcement is where we will be able to analyze more in detail whether the agreement is balanced or not. Generally, at the beginning of the negotiations, what we found was a text that it was something like a wish list drafted by associations of right holders. From that early text, the negotiations, different rounds of negotiations took place, and progressively, and probably in the latest rounds, guarantees protecting consumers and protecting alleged infringers were introduced in the text. And at the end, we found that ACTA resulted in a fairly balanced text from the point of view that we could compare that final version with initial versions. If we analyze the last the treaty that was finally adopted, criminal enforcement probably is one of the most preoccupying sections, particularly because of the criminalization of new activities, as well as the clear standard of proof required in some, to consider that some IP-related activities are of criminal nature. More broadly, I would say that criminal enforcement provisions were not precise enough. When you analyze them from the point of view of the right to fair trial. And another area that was particularly important and tense, and that is still an area of preoccupation, is digital enforcement. Because in digital enforcement, this was what really changed or made ACTA different from previous agreements. As Pedro noted before, ACTA was the first plurilateral treaty addressing digital enforcement. And in this case, what ACTA did was to oblige parties to apply conventional enforcement measures to a digital environment. So in this regard, ACTA commands the application of civil and criminal chapters to infringement occurring online. And this is something totally new. And going back to balance, I think that it's very important to take into consideration that ACTA specifically states There is a limit to enforcement of intellectual property rights. And this limit to enforcement of intellectual property rights is the respect of fundamental rights, so human rights, and another very important legal interest in the international context, which is international trade.
So Pedro, let me turn to you on this, because you know we're talking about ACTA, which never came into force, although as Javi points out, it is a treaty, and so it for lack of a better phrase, it floats out there. But you know, from the perspective of, you know, I think someone listening in the United States, they'd say, you know, the kind of slang they'd say is okay, next, right? In other words, it's not happening. But at the international level, and certainly outside the United States, I think that ACTA, based upon my observations and experience, was much more on the front of the radar screen, and we can talk about it as well, the protests around ACTA. But perhaps you could situate ACTA in the broader international context. And I could ask this question in two ways. I could ask it the crass radio way, which would be, why should we care? But instead I'm going to ask it in a less crass way, although getting at the same point, which is what should we be thinking about vis-a-vis ACTA today and its situation, and then we can kind of dive in a bit into some of the more narrow questions.
Mm-hmm. My comment to what you have said, I think one important consideration that needs to be bear in mind. But before going into there, I would like to emphasize a number of points that were made by Xavi regarding this question of balance. I guess in the final act, I think you will see a number of questions that were not before in the original proposals, like a very clear reference that this agreement doesn't derogate from obligations that exist in other existing agreements, including TRIPS, and also this very curious reference to the Doha Declaration on the TRIPS Agreement and public health. But coming back to your basic question regarding the impact throughout the world of this treaty and what happened after that, no doubt that, and as has been characterized by a number of people, this was called what was categorized as a sort of country club approach. Well, a number of countries that have a similar view on how to go beyond the TRIPS agreement and try to reinforce provisions on enforcement, they got together and in secrecy, as we discussed before, trying to agree on a number of basic lines on how the movement towards strengthening intellectual property should be go forward, and no doubt that the way that was perceived by the outside world, that what these country club countries were trying to reach is basically the major emerging economies, basically China, Brazil, India. And those were countries that no doubt followed this extremely closely. And for the first time, in the discussions within the Council for TRIPS, enforcement was an issue that developing countries were resisting to face. But for the first time, a number of countries, and particularly it was the case of India, raised the issue of the implication that this agreement might have on certain countries. Then there has been a major concern of what might happen, how this approach to enforcement might have an impact in the future on the multilateral system. And I think this is no doubt still alive. As we probably discussed before, if you look at what's going on in the negotiations, particularly on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, the TPP, there are a number of provisions that find their origins in original proposals that were made in the early phase of the ACTA negotiations.
So, General, let me ask you, and you can decide who wants to take this one up, because you know, as we think about ACTA today, right? And again, Hearsay Culture listeners, many of them will be generally familiar with this, right? We've now got these two aforementioned ongoing international negotiations that, at least as far as we know, based upon primarily leaks, not official documents, might have ACTA-like provisions regarding copyright. And when we think about balance, you know, certainly in the United States, but even internationally, we think about those quasi-speech rights that are, you know, that we call fair use in the United States, but really fall broadly into the speech and use provisions in IP rights generally. You know, what is, and this is where you can decide who wants to take it, you know, what's your view on negotiating intellectual property rights issues like copyright infringement and access to information within the trade framework? Because this seems like an enormous challenge, not just for the public who wants access, not just for the public who will be ultimately subject to the laws, but even for the negotiators themselves, who may not have been negotiating these kinds of issues in the trade context before. So I don't know who wants to take that one. I certainly ask for both of your opinions, but what of these issues in the context of trade?
Let me add something. This is Pedro. I think you're raising a very fundamental question. What is the relationship between intellectual property and trade? And I think if one looks back in history, you would very well remember that when the Paris Convention was negotiated in the early part of the 19th century, the Paris Convention of 1883, this was again a very, no doubt, innovative initiative of the United States at that time that wanted to internationalize the patent system particularly. But at that time, it was, Europe was found in the middle of a major controversy about the benefit or disadvantages of a patent system. I think a number of countries at that time, the Netherlands, Switzerland, were fighting if there was a need or not to have a patent system. And then when there was a major controversy at that time in Europe, how you could reconcile intellectual property with free trade. And finally, and I think if you go to the history of the Paris Convention, precisely in a way, the compromise that was found at that time was the question of local exploitation of patents. Then, if you trace the history of the debate since the Paris Convention up to the TRIPS Agreement, you will see that this concept of local working was evolving, and then the notion of compulsory licensing was introduced in the Paris Convention, and when GATT was born, intellectual property was seen as an exception to the free movement of goods. Then I guess the break to this development or the conciliation between intellectual property, in particular patent and trade, in a way was made during the Uruguay round negotiation, where finally countries accepted the view that intellectual property should be one of the pillars of the new international trading system. Since then, and I think in view of a number of basic principles of the TRIPS agreement, basically the set of minimum standards of protection and the possibility of going beyond those international standards of protection, you had a proliferation of free trade agreements that established a number of chapters, especially dedicated to intellectual property, going beyond those minimum standards. Then this this nexus between intellectual property and trade that was controversial at the beginning of the launching of the international system today has been in a way accepted as part of the, is one, as I said before, one of the important pillars of the trading system. But the issue that arises now, and I think Charlie could develop more on that, is that it is completely different to include in those agreements regulatory aspects such as intellectual property and compare those to just trade discussions, opening of barriers to trade, etc., etc. They are completely different. And there is no doubt a major problem that needs to be revisited completely today.
Xavi, before you pick that up, let me just do a quick public service announcement, and then I will hand it right back to you. You're listening, and that is Xavi and Pedro, as well as anyone listening, are listening to KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. As you know, KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways to make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu or go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope they continue to listen to the station as well as to Hearsay Culture. Okay, Xavi, thank you, and please pick up right where you were.
Yeah, continuing with what Pedro was stating, no? That the objective of negotiating intellectual property agreements and trade agreements are different. But it happens that presently we treat all these objectives in the same basket. And this should be probably done differently. As we were pointing out, it has become very common to negotiate intellectual property in the context of trade agreements, but it does not seem the best way of addressing intellectual property regulation. And parties, when they negotiate a trade agreement, generally they expect things like tariff reductions or other types of trade advantages. Intellectual property is, however, entirely different. Intellectual property provisions belong to a much more complex system, I would say, made up of checks and balances. And if in exchange of a tariff reduction you accept extending, for instance, let's say that the number of years of copyright protection or patent protection, you are exchanging advantages of very different nature, and not only different nature, but also of very different addresses and of very different effects. So the advisability or the convenience of doing this is something that should be reviewed. The other side of the coin, naturally, is that by negotiating intellectual property within the trade framework, you ensure that the generally more advantageous dispute settlement mechanism set forth in trade agreements will apply to intellectual property controversies. This, which I would say that is in principle a positive feature, should, however, accompany intellectual property regimes of balanced nature, which is not always, and which is not even frequently the case in the context of trade negotiations.
So, gentlemen, as we think about these issues now, I'll ask you the fundamental question, which is, do you think, in light of these concerns, that IP should be negotiated within the trade framework? Because you refer to ACTA as a plurilateral enforcement agenda, and Xavi, perhaps I'll ask you, just so we're clear for listeners, what does plurilateral mean in the negotiation context? And then, if you have an answer to that question, that would be great with regard to IP and trade.
Okay, well, very simply, a plurilateral agreement is a form of a multilateral agreement, but with a reduced membership. And this reduced membership is not because of the number of parties, but because of the reasons that allow parties to be part of this agreement. Let's say, for instance, a regional agreement that restricts participation to the countries pertaining to a specific region is an agreement of close membership. In this case, in the context of ACTA, we also find the same. It's a plurilateral agreement. Why? Because the number of countries or the countries that that agreed to negotiate this treaty had very similar views. They wanted to reach a very concrete outcome, and they created this form of club that permitted them to conduct the negotiations in a, I would say, more easy, in an easier manner than it would have happened if they had moved these negotiations into the multilateral context, where you will have different views, more pressure, and other actors that will probably challenge the visibility of the treaty itself.
Pedro, yeah, do you want to add anything on that front?
Yeah, may I add something? Well, TRIPS, that no doubt is one of the major agreements in the evolution of intellectual property law, was done in a multilateral framework. And I think this is no doubt something that one could say, well, you could do it when there is will to do it. When you move to a plurilateral level, and I think in this respect it's quite interesting to look at the TPP. The TPP process involves 12 countries. And if you look at the composition of the group, you will see that all of these 12 countries, they have agreements among themselves, most of them. I think if you take the case of the United States, probably the United States doesn't have an agreement, a free trade agreement, if I'm not wrong, with New Zealand and with Malaysia. But otherwise, with the other 10 countries, the United States has agreement and has agreements that include chapters dealing with intellectual property. Then it's quite interesting that what you have here is a phenomenon of double agreements, double preferential trade agreements that are being negotiated in the context of the TPP. But your question was basically why countries negotiating that in that environment. I think you need to compare those countries that are more advanced, especially in the area of intellectual property, with countries that are less advanced. And in the case of TPP, for example, you have countries like Vietnam, like Peru, like Chile, and even Malaysia, that they are not at the level of intellectual property protection at the other countries, especially the United States. They are negotiating those agreements precisely because they want to benefit from being part of a major understanding from a point of view of geography, from the point of politics, it will be a major understanding, a major agreement that doesn't cover only intellectual property. For those countries, intellectual property, they are not the demanders in that area, but they are very much interested in other areas that are being negotiated, especially market access.
We're chatting with Pedro Ruffy and Javi Soiba, authors and co-editors in The ACTA and the Plurilateral Enforcement Agenda. So, gentlemen, let's turn now to the relationship between these kinds of agreements and domestic politics. You know, one of the challenges, I think, with these issues and thinking about ACTA is that once you have an agreement at the international level, it then has to go to the signatory countries and make it through their domestic process. You know, what's your take, and perhaps, Xavi, I'll come back to you. You know, what's your take on the challenges of negotiating international agreements that ultimately have to go to signatory countries? Is it a system that works? Are there concerns that you have? How would you frame that issue?
Well, it is totally necessary. No, you international treaties first are negotiated internationally, but afterwards they need to go through the internal ratification processes. I think that once treaties have been adopted, the domestic relevance of these treaties is not only can be assessed not only from the point of view of the I would say actual litigation that has to do with the treaty itself, but mainly with the legislative reforms that these treaties promote. So I would say that at the domestic level, you can broadly identify two effects of these international treaties. One is universal, in the sense that parties will need to amend the legislation as required by the treaty, and the other will depend very much on the constitutional reception of international law. For instance, this is not the case in the States, but in Latin American countries or in Spain, for instance, international treaties have direct effect. This has permitted intellectual property treaties, such as the TRIPS agreement, to be the ones that have attracted the most important litigation ever in countries such as Spain. There are as well many other reasons to engage in intellectual property lawmaking. If from the international point of view, I would say, if you look at how intellectual property legislation has changed in the last 25 years, we could probably not understand it without the adoption of many international treaties. These treaties naturally have a very heterogeneous content and membership, but even if their level of domestic enforcement is not totally satisfactory, this is just a question of time, while the changes that these treaties introduce are, well, they are systemic, you know, are very profound.
So, Pedro, let me turn to you, and we're getting to the point of the show, incidentally, that I call the unfair portion of the show. And this is where I start asking questions that you may not have the time that you'd like to answer fully. But then I do it anyway because it's a radio show, and that's what hosts do for fun. We haven't talked much about it here, but I think it's so critical, and I've certainly focused on it heavily, and I think it's worth discussing, which is the secrecy around the process itself. At least in my estimation, and this is my question for you before we talk about the need for it. You know, you mentioned that ACTA became more balanced as the agreement was negotiated, and yet it wasn't ultimately successful. And my theory on that is because the process trumped the substance. In other words, there was so much secrecy around it that it caused naysayers and people that even might not have liked any agreement at the international level on these issues to say, look, they're hiding stuff from us, and that caused enormous opposition that wouldn't have otherwise existed. So that's my operating theory on ultimately why ACTA died or didn't become effective. What's your take on the impact of the secrecy around the negotiations? And I know you have several chapters in the book, including by the scholars like Michael Geist, who have written on this extensively. But what's your opinion as to the impact of the secrecy? And then, Xavi, I'll come back to you really to ask you about the need for it. Pedro?
Yeah. let me relate this question to the previous one relating to the impact on the domestic level. And these are questions that are very much related. The domestic level, I think if you look at the countries that they have signed these new agreements that include more strong protection, especially those ones that they have signed, free trade agreements, especially with the United States, because of the most favorable nation treatment that you have basic principle in WTO, particularly in the case of TRIPS, what is negotiated with the United States applies to everybody, and the United States is quite careful in trying to monitor the implementation of these agreements in specific countries. And I think one major instrument of the United States is Section 301 and the annual report of the USTR, where it follows and it monitors what countries are doing in relation to the implementation of their law. And from that point of view, the secrecy of these processes and the case of ACT and the secrecy that is going on today in the case of the TPP, no doubt that will have a major impact at the domestic level when the negotiators finish their work and they will have to disclose to the large community what they have done. Most of the countries that are negotiating ACTA, TPP, are democratic governments, and they will have to expose what they have done to Congress. And in those countries, and I know very well some of the countries in Latin America, they are becoming extremely careful of what is being negotiated, especially negotiations in secrecy of major things, as Xavi was saying, that will have a long-term impact in terms of development, in terms of creativity, in terms of innovation, etc., then I foresee difficulties, and I think this is one of the major lessons that one could get from the ACTA negotiation, that secrecy was a failure in the case of ACTA and might be another failure in the case of the TPP when this is exposed to the scrutiny of the community.
Xavi, do you want to add anything on those points?
Yeah, I think that the question that we should raise is, well, why, if internal processes, normative processes to negotiate intellectual property are in principle transparent, why not international intellectual property normative processes? No? What ACTA has showed is that it was a mistake, as Pedro was saying, not to disclose the content, not to share the content of the negotiations. And the failure of the agreement is not probably because of the content of the final act, but because of the transparency, the lack of transparency of the overall process. So this raises a number of questions as well. Obviously, I'm totally in favor of full transparency in the context of intellectual property negotiations. This does not mean that the states cannot adopt unpopular positions and even reach unpopular agreements. This is totally different. But a related aspect is that concerning the parties that should be informed about the content of the agreement. So, for instance, why some business associations are allowed to participate in the negotiations, even in following the negotiations in the side rooms, and why some NGOs and not other NGOs, for instance. This indeed forms part of a larger debate and more complex debate, not yet solved, but there may exist different grades of participation depending on the capacity to propose meaningful provisions in the context of international negotiations, but it is very important to address the question of the legitimacy of actors influencing on these normative processes. I think that overall it would be highly useful not to use IP as a bargaining chip in the context of trade negotiations, and this has to do with transparency, because you will only keep in secret what you are in the position to trade in exchange of something different. No? If IP was not a bargaining chip, probably there will be no problem to have full access to the text of negotiations.
So, gentlemen, let me ask you this question as a pushback question, because, and Xavi, I'll direct it to you and then come back to Pedro. You said something very interesting there in your answer, which is that you believe that countries can take unpopular positions within a, as you put it, totally transparent negotiation process. So when I have had these discussions with people who are more aligned with the U.S. Trade Representative's positions or with the occasionally with staffers who negotiate on behalf of other countries, the general response with regard to why we've had secrecy or why there's less transparency is actually the exact opposite of what you said, Xavi. The belief that the horse trading and negotiation that goes on in international agreements cannot be done with the glare of public scrutiny, because that negotiating process itself wouldn't be possible when people were second guessing and challenging every move. So, what's your response to that? Yeah, and of course, before I ask you your response, I'll note that this is the long-standing general received wisdom in the world of international trade and diplomacy. So what's your response to that criticism that no bargaining can't happen with access to negotiating texts?
Well, I think that you cannot treat people, and by people I mean scholars, NGOs, companies that are not as interested in certain levels of IP protection as others, as actors that need not to be taken into consideration. They should obviously be taken into consideration, and they are capable of following these discussions and to give meaningful contribution to the text of the treaties. In fact, if you look at ACTA, it was very interesting that probably for the first time you had companies representing very different views on the function or on the levels of intellectual property protection, the desirable levels of intellectual property protection, trying to influence on this process. But some of these stakeholders had access, direct access to the negotiations, while others did not have. So why is that? I think that if you consider, and when I say you, I mean the government considers that lay people are not in the position to meaningfully participate in the negotiations, this should apply to everybody, not only for some. And this was not the case in ACTA, and it seems that is not the case in general in trade negotiations. I would like to underline that in the last 15, 20 years has emerged a very powerful community, international community of intellectual property experts, that they are, well, adscribed, they belong to research institutions, NGOs, universities, and they have created what they will term like a sort of a global epistemic community. They're very learned, they know what is the meaning of what it is discussed, and they can contribute meaningfully to these discussions. You can see these in proposals taking place in WIPO, in proposals taking place in the World Health Organization relating to treaties, relating to innovation in the pharmaceutical sector. So it is a different area. Presently, it is not anymore the case that foreign trade representatives negotiate among themselves international texts, but these texts have to be negotiated with a broader range of stakeholders.
Pedro, and do you want to add anything in about 1 minute?
Well, I will add to what was said by Xavi, that no doubt that the world has changed a lot in the last 20 years or more. In the past, and I guess probably before TRIPS, intellectual property was always considered a domain of experts, a reserve area that outsiders could not intervene. Precisely, probably because of TRIPS, intellectual property has become a very sensitive area. People are realizing with much more clarity that intellectual property deals with fundamental issues, access to health, access to education, access to knowledge, etc. Then because of that becomes a difficult issue. And I guess the role of internet, no doubt a major creation, a major revolution in recent years, opens this whole things to a broader discussion. We are living in a difficult world, but the response could not be secrecy. You create a bigger problem with that.
Pedro Raffi, Xavi Soiba, editors of the book The ACTA and the Plurilateral Enforcement Agenda. I'm going to ask you, now this is classic radio stuff, and I apologize in advance because I'm going to ask a question and I'm going to give each of you 10 seconds on it. So if there is one takeaway for listeners who are not international trade experts or even focus on it from the ACTA experience, what is it? And Pedro, I'll ask you, and then Xavi will ask you, and I'll hold you to the classic radio. 10 seconds, please.
Okay.
Pedro.
Well, I think the whole idea of preparing the book was precisely to draw lessons of an experience that we thought that was not a good experience. Maybe the idea was a good one, but one lesson is that what I said before, the world has changed. You could not keep things of this nature in secret.
Xavi.
Okay, no, the idea on the top of that was also to reflect the broader political and social context surrounding contemporary intellectual property norms and in this case in the international context. And it was also a purpose of this book to map what is going to be probably present in future agreements.
Gentlemen, the book, The ACTA and the Plurilateral Enforcement Agenda, editors Pedro Ruffy and Xavi Soiba. You know, Hearsay Culture has, I'm proud to say, an international audience. However, the genesis of the show was to bring issues to my listeners that I personally think deserve more attention, and international law is front and center in that. Your book, I think, is a wonderful addition and important contribution to our understanding of ACTA, from which we can derive many lessons. Congratulations on the book, on, as I said earlier, bringing together a wonderful group of scholars, and thank you much for your patience through scheduling and for joining us today on the show.
Thank you very much.
So this is the last show for this spring quarter on KZSU's schedule. We are going to, as is usual, take the break that we do during the interim period, where we will not have new shows. But then, once we're done with that portion of the interim schedule, we will be back in the spring for a new round of shows. And I'll be announcing the schedule for the spring schedule on KZSU and Hearsay Culture within the next several weeks. I'm also excited to mention, and I've mentioned this in the past, that Hearsay Culture's website is nearing completion for its full overhaul. I have seen the mock-ups of the site, and I'm very excited about it, and I look forward to putting it out there. So look for that in the coming weeks, and also I will be extending some enormous thanks to those that worked on it shortly. On top of all that, a reminder that you can listen to Hearsay Culture this quarter at noon on Wednesdays Pacific Time by going to kzsulive.stanford.edu. You can also get all previous 230 shows as well as the upcoming schedule by going to hearsayculture.com. And you can listen to the show via podcast by going to hearsayculture.com or the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School's iTunes page and webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. As always, I welcome comments, suggestions, and feedback. And incidentally, once the new site is live, also comments on the new design, anything that should change, anything you like and don't like, at dave@hearsayculture.com. So thank you for joining me today on the show. Please stay tuned for KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.